Okay, let's get started. Before we get started, I'd just like to say a welcome to some visitors that we have from China who are going to be just observing this lesson. So welcome to you. Last time we... Is this microphone turned on?
No.
How about that? Is that better? No? Is that it? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so last time we were looking at testing, and we went through a number of different aspects of that. What I want to start off with today is JUnit, which I've mentioned before, and which some of you are no doubt already familiar with. So JUnit is a framework for Java testing that's really widely used. It's open source, and you need to do enough investigation of JUnit and play around with it enough that you're confident and familiar with how to write basic JUnit tests and run them. And so you need to understand how to do that, and understand the ideas behind test-first development that we went through last time. There are a lot of possible places that you can go and look for help with that. Some of the better ones are the JUnit website itself has some examples and tutorials. Eclipse has some help material, and it has some examples that you can also try out. And so you can run JUnit from within Eclipse, or you can work with it outside Eclipse, and which you do is up to you. There's also a JUnit tutorial that it's worth working through. It shows you how to get started with Eclipse, and if you have any trouble, then it's worth working through that. So let's take a quick look at that. I'm obviously not going to go through the whole lot of it. But this is the tutorial that link points at. That's linked off the resources page of the course webpage. So I'm not going to go through all of this, but what I will show you is what a JUnit test looks like, a very simple one. So if we have a simple class like this, class my class with a method multiply that just multiplies two integers together and returns the result. If you wanted to make a test of that, then what you're going to be doing is making a call on this method. You're going to invoke this method with some particular numbers that you know what their multiplication is. Now this, for some reason, has the wrong symbol here. So that's not a very good, so that's going to fail. But this is the way you would write a test for that. So you've got the same package. It's going to be in the test is in the same package. You import the JUnit test framework. You import a particular methods. So in this case, we're importing the assert equals method. I'll talk a bit more about that. And then you create a new class that traditionally is the name of the class that you're testing, followed by the word test. And you annotate it with this at test. This is called an annotation in Java, if you haven't come across these before. And that tells JUnit this is a test that is going to be able to be run. And then you create test methods that, again, traditionally, it's lowercase test followed by the name of the method that you're testing. And obviously, in good Java tradition, you're going to make that M an uppercase, whereas it was lowercase in the original method. So what this does is create an instance of the class that you're testing, my class, and then it is going to call that method multiply from this instance with these two parameters. So you'd expect the result 50 for if this multiplication was going to work. And assert equals, you can look up the signature of what this means, but it's going to throw an error if this number here isn't equal to the result of this method call, which obviously it should be. And in this particular case, it's not going to be because there was a division symbol there instead of a multiplication symbol. So that's just to show you the kind of thing that you need to do to write these tests. This assert equals is a particular kind of assertion. I'll talk about assertions in a minute that will test whether two things are equal. There are a variety of different assertions that are possible. For example, assert true, which tests whether a Boolean result is true or false, and various other ones that you can look up in the Java doc. So you can either import specific test assertions that you want to use, or you can import the whole package with a star here. Okay, so that's what it looks like. And I'll leave you to go through some of these examples so that you're familiar with actually really doing this. Okay, so that's JUnit. I'm not going to talk about JUnit anymore, but it is, as I say, very important that you do know how to use it. And in your second part of your assignment, if you create any new code or you modify existing code, then make sure that you test it properly using JUnit or some other. I would prefer JUnit. And quite likely, if you're modifying existing code, there are already existing tests there, in which case you may need to modify those tests. So that's all part of the assignment. Okay, let's do a little clicker question. Last time we looked at these two terms, verification and validation. Testing is something that you use to do both of these. So here are a number of statements. Just a second, I'll get rid of it. See if I can get rid of that. Okay, here are a number of statements about verification and validation. So three about verification and three about validation. And only two of these are true. So the question is, which two of them are true? So I'll give you just a little bit of time to look at those and work out which ones are true. Okay, let's run this. So you've got four possibilities there. And I think, yeah. If you haven't decided by now, it's time to guess. Okay, so what do we have here? So most people, or more than anything else, thought C was correct. That's number two and five. And a variety of others, A, D, and B. Okay, let's go through these. I'll show you what the right answers are, if I can. So the right answer is C. So many of you are remembering this. It is quite hard to remember, but it's something that you should remember. And basically, one way of remembering it is that validation is, are we building the right software? So that means, essentially, is it what the customer wants? So the correct answer for validation is the process of checking the software does what the customer wants. Verification is, are we building the software correctly? So in other words, does the software meet the requirements that are stated? So that's the process of checking the software matches the requirements. So as you can tell from reading those, if you don't actually know this precisely, it can be a bit confusing to try and work it out. But if you can remember this, validation is the right software, verification is the software right. If you can remember that order, then you'll remember this. Okay, let's go on and talk a little more about other aspects of testing. So, there are a number of limitations of testing. It's time-consuming to write tests. That's one of the major problems. So what that means is that it's tedious, and people don't like to write thorough tests that test everything. So what happens in practice, this shouldn't happen in theory, but in practice what happens is that you almost never get complete coverage with a test suite. And so what that means is that the test suite may not actually check for a particular bug. It's also difficult to test certain kinds of errors. So it's difficult to provide a test environment that actually duplicates what happens in real life. So for example, race conditions. Now, who knows what a race condition is? A few of you. Okay, you all need to know what race conditions are. What's a race condition?
Well, it's when information propagates at different speeds through a pipeline. And you get an intermediate, you use an intermediate result instead of what you're expected to use, because two different variables take different times to compute on a parallel compute.
Okay, does anybody else want to improve on that?
When two components are executed
Okay. Well, you're both kind of on the right track. A race condition is when there need to be multiple threads of execution for a race condition to occur. You can't, if it's a single thread of execution, then you can't have a race condition. If there are multiple threads, then a race condition occurs when the result that you get depends on which of these two threads, or more than two threads, happens to get to an endpoint in first. So that, and that's the sense that it's a race. So a classic example of this is if you have a, for example, a web-based system that provides access to documents, and there's controls on access to documents. So some people can set who can see the document, and some people can't. And if you have permission to see a document, you can see it. Okay. So somebody goes to view a document, they can see it if they have access control. If two people with the right authorities are logged in and they both try to reset the access permissions at the same time, then which one is going to succeed? And that depends on the speed with which various things are happening. So that's a kind of race condition that, and it's very difficult to, impossible really, to account for those, to properly test for those in a test environment. And they can be some of the hardest bugs to find. Okay, so you can also only test things that are actually executable. So you can test code. There are test frameworks that will allow you to simulate sort of clicking into web browsers and so on. So you can simulate user clicks, and it will test the code that deals with that. But there's no automated way of testing high-level designs. There are certain sorts of things that you can do with particular kinds of high-level designs, but there isn't any kind of generally useful framework for it. And tests are much more valuable, as I've said before, if you write them early, preferably before you even write any code, because they help to clarify and document the requirements, which is not much use if you've already written all the code and you then go and clarify the requirements. It just means you've got to change some code. So another approach is to do what are called reviews, and these are sometimes also known as walkthroughs and inspections. There's a variety of terms for this. But the general idea is that you get a group of people to look at the problem. So this isn't an automated procedure at all. But you can find bugs this way that are hard to find by testing. You can look at requirement specifications. So you can look at, you have a group of people look at the requirement specification, say, is there a problem in this requirement specification? Like, for example, there are incompatible requirements. And you can, by doing this sort of thing, you can focus on where there are problems that, with the sort of conceptualization of what's going on. So people, there isn't clarity about what the right thing to do is. And it's a funny thing, but if you're working on a design or a set of requirements or some coding, it's very easy to not see a problem that is absolutely glaring to somebody else when they come and look at it. So just getting another brain on the problem can show quite a lot of benefits. So for our purposes, all these different things, reviews, walkthroughs, and inspections, we can all talk about them, call them reviews, although there are fine distinctions in the literature about the different characteristics of these. So a review generally is a meeting of a few people. It looks at a specific artifact, so a design document or a piece of code. It looks for specific entry criteria that have been passed. So if the code's already compiled, then that's then it will the group will only look at code that's already compiled or design documents that have already been through some sort of quality control. And people look at these before the meeting, So everybody is coming to the meeting with an understanding of what they're looking at, what they're discussing, with some idea of their own problems, what they see as problems with the document or the code, and then somebody presents it, and then there's a discussion, and the meeting doesn't try to fix anything, it just tries to identify where there are problems. So it's a very particular kind of structured meeting to tease out problems in documents, code, architectural diagrams, and so on. And very important, meeting, like all meetings, has a fixed time, should have a fixed time limit, which is to encourage people to not waste time. So that's one thing you can do. You can do other kinds of analyses, which are often divided up into static and dynamic. So dynamic analysis means you have to be running the code and you're looking at what happens over time, or at least some simulation of the code. Static analysis doesn't, so the code looks at the code without running it. The tool looks at the code without running it. So both of them need to be clear what's being checked, and that can be kind of very general sort of statements, such as this code doesn't deadlock, which you can imagine might be quite a hard thing to be very confident of, since it's in general undecidable. And things like, there'll be no null pointer exception, or they can be in terms of other things like, is the Java dot, are the Java dot comments correct? So some of the things that you can do with these kinds of tests are, as I've talked about, assertions, and they allow you to do these sanity checks. So this is an example of an assertion. We saw one in the unit test. This is a sort of more general one. So we can write this in Java, we can write assert i% 2 equals 0. So the percent operator means modulus. So what this is going to do is say I has got to be even. And if when the code is running, the I is not even when it gets to this assertion, then an assertion error will be flagged, an exception will be flagged up. So this is built into Java. This isn't something that you need to import a library for. But it's not as, it doesn't have the same utility of the JUnit test framework. So obviously assertion checking should be switched off for release, because If there are errors in that you haven't caught, you don't particularly want those to cause an exception that may cause the program to just shut down. So one of the things, the rules about assertions that's very important, and this is true of any kind of assertion, you must never do anything in an assertion that has side effects. Now, who knows what side effects are? Changing variables, yeah, that's an example of a side effect. Yeah, okay, so side effects are where you have, is anything that causes a change in state, in the data state. So changing a variable is an example of a side effect. And if you change a variable in an assertion, then when you have assertions turned on, that variable will get changed. And then when you go to release the code, with the assertions turned off, that variable won't get changed. So you'll have been testing different pieces of software. So that's a very simple kind of runtime check. Now there are more complex variants on this. And these include preconditions. So that's a condition that's true when a method or a piece of code, a block of code, or whatever is invoked. Post conditions, which is the same, but when the block of code or the method finishes, and invariants. So invariants are conditions that should always be true of a given class. And more generally, you can have invariants. So that would be a class invariant. You can have other kinds of invariants as well. So always is quite a strong word. And what always means is in all client visible states. So in other words, when the object is executing, it may be sort of manipulating its internal data, but none of that's ever visible to the outside world. It may be that the invariant during the time that data is being manipulated may become false, and that's okay. It's so long as the outside world can never see that state. So there's a whole language to do these kinds of assertions, the Java modeling language. So that allows you to annotate Java programs with these kind of preconditions, postconditions, and so on. So it's a bit like Java doc, and it looks like this sort of statement. So precondition, what this says is that this method, for example, requires that variable x is positive. Post condition, this would be that the result is even. This is that the length of the main variable is never greater than 8. So you can also put in general assertions, just like the assert statement. So there are lots that this JML provides lots of different kinds of extensions to Java expressions. So for example, you can put in quantifiers like for all and there exists and so on. So you can assert quite complex statements about the state of the code at a particular point in the in execution. So that's dynamic analysis, and running the program with assertion checking turned on is a basic kind of dynamic analysis. There are a variety of tools, some of which are listed here, that compile and run Java code that's been annotated in these ways into bytecode that's got specific kinds of assertion checking that happens at runtime. And so you need to read more about this. I'm not going to go into this in any more detail, but if you look at this is linked off the schedule page for the course, and you should take a look at it and read section 1. So that's required. The rest, it would be a good idea to look at, and it would be a good idea to read and write some simple examples. Okay, so let's do another little clicker question. So if we have preconditions and postconditions, if you saw these statements, which of these would you think were true? So preconditions refer to the results of the method and to the arguments, postcondition refers to the arguments, pre and post both refer to the arguments, pre refers to the arguments, post to the arguments and the result. So let's see what everybody thinks about that. You've got four choices again. Okay, I'm going to stop this at 10 so that. Okay, so most people thought B, so that's 2 and 3. Some people thought just C, 1 and 3, and one person thought they're all true. Okay, well let's have a look at these. So preconditions are about what's true before. So one of the things that's true that we know about before is that we don't know the result. Right? So preconditions can't refer to the result. So one can't be true. Sorry? Did I? So two can be true. Pre and post conditions can both refer to the arguments. And three can also be true. So pre can refer to the arguments and post can refer to the arguments and the results. So two and three, so B is the right answer here. Okay. Go to that again. Okay, so now static analysis, this is done just by looking at the code. So one of the tools that you have that looks at the code is the compiler, right? Because it compiles it into bytecode. So it can do various kinds of checking when it compiles. And type checking is one of those kinds of things. So the static analysis that you can do in languages like Java is much more extensive than in older languages like C++. So for example, in Java, the compiler knows something typically about the kind of object that an object reference, the kind of object that's referred to by an object reference. And so it can infer whether a type constraint has been satisfied or not. Whereas in C++, where you deal directly with pointers, or you can deal directly with pointers, the compiler in those cases can't assume anything about what the pointer is pointing at. So it can't make the same kind of checks. So a more strongly typed language like Java enables the more static analysis. And there's quite an interesting kind of static analysis that I heard about recently that hasn't yet made it into any tools, but I think it might well soon, which is to take a look at all the open source projects, that all the code that's out there, Java code that's out there that is publicly accessible to all the open source projects on SourceForge and all the other sites that you've been looking at. And you can consider each of the classes there that you can access, and there's probably millions of them. You can consider that a document. And there's a lot of work being done in the natural language field to understand documents and to classify documents and find documents that are similar. So the idea in this new proposed tool is to learn something from the massive range of examples that are out there, so that you can compare some code that somebody is writing in something like Eclipse. If this tool was built as a plugin to Eclipse, it would compare what you're writing with millions of classes that other people have written out in the open source world, and potentially suggest you've written a structure that's a bit like this other structure. You might want to, think about using this library that all these other people have used. So that's not an analysis for correctness, but it's an analysis that might actually be very, very useful as a practical programming tool. So there are a lot of different kinds of tools that look at code in one way or another. So they look at things like, did you check the return value for error codes? Are there pre and post conditions that are correct? Sometimes there are checks for concurrency bugs. And so these are additional tools that you can use to help you find bugs. They don't replace testing. They're kind of complementary to testing. So they're not sound. You're not guaranteed that every time one of these tools says you've got a problem, it might not actually be a problem, and they're definitely not complete. They're not going to find all the problems. So that here are three tools that you could take a look at if you're interested. Well, two tools really, and a possible set of tools. This one is for static analysis of JML annotated programs, and of course many Java programs aren't annotated with JML, so it's only useful for those. And that uses theorem proving methods to prove the correctness of assertions. Find bugs is more commonly used. There's a spin-out company from Informatics that's producing a new generation of this kind of tool. Okay, so that's all I'm going to do on testing. And there's, just to reiterate, you should read chapter 11 on software quality. You definitely need to know how to use JUnit, how to annotate tests to run with JUnit, and I suggest you take a look at some of these as well. Okay, let's go on and look at other issues. So this is onto a new topic, software deployment and maintenance. So deployment is when you're moving the software from the hands of the developers out into the hands of the users. That's deploying it. And if we look at commissioned software, so that's software where a development team has been established to produce a particular piece of software for a customer or perhaps a small group of customers. More than half of that kind of software that's commissioned isn't actually used, and mostly because it fails at the point that it's transitioned from the development team out to the users. And the cost of software, if you look at the total cost of a software project, 80% of it comes at deployment and after deployment. So if you're writing code, if you're part of the software engineering team and you're focused on writing the code for the system, you have to remember you're only 20% of the activity. So you might wonder why it predominates so much. Why do things fail so much at deployment time, and why is it so expensive? Well, one of the reasons is that it's not that deployment itself is the problem, it's that the problem shows up when you go to deploy. So, for example, you've built your software, the software system, you think it meets the requirements, you take it out to the customer, and turns out it's not what they want. So, there was no way you were going to know that. Well, it's possible you didn't get enough requirements, it's possible you didn't interact enough with the customer, but it's not a sort of a coding issue or anything like that. It's that in some way the software isn't meeting the requirements. And a good example of this that I've talked a little bit about before is the National Program for IT for the National Health Service in England and Wales, which was essentially cancelled within the last year. And at the time it was established, almost 10 years ago, it was considered to be the largest IT project ever done. And that, to a significant extent, failed at the deployment stage, because when they tried to deploy it out to doctors' medical practices, people said, this isn't doing what we want. And consequently, it's not being deployed. But that said, there are also, actually, deployment has of itself quite a lot of specific difficulties. So one of those is business processes. So almost any large software system, when it goes into a company or a public sector organization, it will require the people who are using it to change how they work. And actually, the NP-FIT system or program was exactly of that nature. I remember back in 2003 going to a talk by the director of sales for IBM Europe, and he was talking about IBM bidding into the MPFIT program, trying to get some business. And he identified a number of difficulties with doing this, but one of them was that he didn't see how the change management was going to be handled. IBM had estimated that for every person they put into the project, for every person IBM was employing on the project, the NHS would need to put in 5 people to manage all the change around the different how processes were going to change. So, you know, training the nurses in how they're going to use the system, training the doctors to work a different way so they can use it, all those sorts of things, training the managers in how to get different statistics out, all those sorts of things. So IBM was, for the London bid that they were putting in, they were going to put in 1,000 people onto this project, which meant that they were expecting that the NHS was going to need to put in 5,000 people to manage the change. And he said, where are they going to get 5,000 people from? You know, they're going to pull 5,000 people out of the hospitals and the practices, and who's going to backstop them? And that's another reason why NPFIT didn't work, and it happens in a lot of cases. So change management is, it's not a software engineering kind of issue, but it can seriously impact on the viability of your project. So you do have to be aware of it. As I said, training is an important part of all of this. So there's no point in just putting software out in front of people and say, there you go. You have to be, there has to be a whole training program. And developing training programs is a whole area in itself. There are always continuing needs for support. Actually getting the software out to people is an issue. How do you physically get to them? Do they download it? Do you send them a CD? You know, what is the process? Does the customer have the right hardware? You know, you've built this for Linux machines and they want it to run on Windows, and somehow, you know, they didn't know that. In some cases, the customer doesn't actually have the IT expertise in-house to deploy the software. And the company that I'm associated with, we find this all the time. We're trying to deploy software into scientific labs. And quite often, the lab doesn't have an IT person. And when we say, well, you need to install MySQL and Tomcat, and they go, what? You know, they have no idea what we're talking about. So these are all aspects of understanding what the market is for the software, but it's the kind of thing that can kill it. You can't avoid doing upgrades. Of course, people want new capabilities. You find that you want to put in new capabilities to get a new market. So you have to manage upgrades. Questions there are things like, well, how many previous versions are we going to support? Every version back that you agree to support is more effort. You have to maintain the code base. You probably have to fix bugs in it. Integration with other systems of the customer. Now, that's something that should have been thought about at requirements time. It's not something you should find out about when you go to deploy, but depending on the time frame that the project has happened under, it may be that the customer's systems have changed during your development process. So it's another aspect that has to be handled. And of course, there are performance issues. You know, is this going to run fast enough, and so that people will actually use it? So there are a lot of tools that will help you to do some of these things, not the really hard ones, but they'll do some of the ones that are somewhat automatable. So you can get tools that will package up your software. They'll take your Java classes and configuration files and so on, and they'll package it up and make it available in some easy form, like on a DVD or for download. and they'll give customers installers, the kind of thing that you're used to when you click, you know, download, and then you click run, and then it says opening the installer, and you just do next, 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 and then it's installed. So there are tools that will build all that for you, tools that will check that the system that it's being installed on has the right components already. So for example, does it have the right Java JVM? And then it'll actually do the installation, you know, put it in the right folders or directories or whatever, make sure the permissions are correct, and deal with licenses and so on, and a whole lot of other issues. So one system that's used quite widely for Java programs is Java Web Start. And you can see the suggested reading for more information about that. What Java Web Start is supposed to be is a system that will allow you to download essentially a Java program and just run it. But it's not all it's cracked up to be, certainly not in my experience, because it requires things like that the customer actually has Java on their machine, which isn't always the case, surprisingly, or that they've got a reasonably recent version of Java. And it's surprising in how many cases this doesn't work effectively. Nevertheless, it does work reasonably well in many cases, and so it is quite widely used, and it's worth understanding. There are good commercial packages to do this kind of packaging up the software and making it available, building your installers and so on. And Install4j, if you're looking for one of these things, is a good commercial one. There's the best open source one that we've found is IZPack, and all of these will build these little installers and let people just click through them. So once you've actually deployed, you've then got maintenance issues. Whatever testing regime you've done, however careful you've been, there will be bugs. And there will certainly be new features required unless you're doing something very esoteric like building a control system for a piece of hardware that's only going to ever be used once. So the circumstances in which the software is used quite often change. And so the software has to change. And one of the questions is who's going to change it? It's not unusual for the development team that wrote the original software to be disbanded, to be broken up, or at least many members of the team to leave once the project's been delivered, because it may well be the case that the kind of skills you need to do maintenance and support and upgrades are different from the kind of skills you need to build the system originally. So it's quite likely that the people who are doing maintenance are not the people who built the software originally. Even with good documentation and training and handover, which a lot of those things don't happen as well as they should, you still end up getting architectural degradation. So the people bolt things on, and the original architecture becomes, isn't really driving things. So you need to have systems to deal with this. And one of the tools that's useful for dealing with bugs are tracking systems. And I'm just going to show you quickly an example of a bug tracking system. So this is a bug tracking system actually for the software company that I work with. And so you can see here, for version 3.3, here's a set of bugs or issues, and that it's categorized here into bugs. So these are things that are, problems with the software, and features, which are new capabilities that customers have asked for or that we've decided would be a good thing to include. And so you can see what's included. These kinds of systems allow you to prioritize which of these things are going to be fixed. They allow you to set who's going to deal with the problem. You can make estimates of how long it's going to take and so on. So there are a variety of tools that do this, and they're pretty much essential to use one of these systems. This particular one is Track. There are others, Bugzilla, Jira, which is from Atlassian, is very widely used. So this is another kind of tool that it would be good to become somewhat familiar with if you aren't already. So over time, the piece of software will evolve, and you'll need to make new releases. Those need to be managed. So the general process that you go through is you gather over time a set of change requirements. So which bugs that need fixing, the kind of thing that I showed you on that the Track system, feature requests, and so on. At some point, you evaluate those. You produce a list of changes that you're actually going to propose to make for the release. And then you go through a normal kind of development cycle to implement those changes. And if the team isn't the team that built it originally, then you may need to invest quite a lot of time in actually understanding the existing structure. And then you issue the new release after it's been developed and tested and so on. And the sort of time frame for this can be very short if you're using an agile methodology, so it could be as short as a week, in which case you don't typically use anything quite as formal as this. But more normally, for non-agile teams, you'll be doing releases maybe every 6 months or something like that. So the time frame over which you do this can vary a lot. If you're doing a web application, then you're probably doing lots of little releases. If you're doing a critically important piece of software that's running on the main systems of a bank, then you're probably not doing releases that frequently. Okay. So re-engineering, sometimes you have to do that when there's the software is so old or badly set up that you need to you don't need to re-implement it, but you need to make some major changes. So for example, translate to a different language. Maybe you need to, some of the code you don't even have the source for anymore, so you need to reconstitute the source by analyzing the program. Sometimes you need to change the way things are modularized, or if they're not modularized, then change that. So refactoring